Meeting is now being recorded.
Thank you very much, and everyone, welcome to the CCWP Hacking in Human Rights. Today is Wednesday the 20th of February 2019. I'll pass the mic over to Pauline. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, good morning, good evening, good afternoon, and everyone, and welcome to this meeting. Seems like David and possibly other people are having issues with the audio. Is there anyone else who can't hear me speaking? Can anyone ever not hear me? Okay, great. He's got it fixed. Perfect. Welcome, David. So today is a really exciting day because we're going to be discussing work that has been in construction for the past, for the better part of the past year. So we've got a pretty packed agenda, so I think that we can dive right in. Let's see here. Oh, here we go. Here's the agenda for today. As you can see, about half or maybe a little bit more than half of the meeting will be dedicated to looking over the different multi-stakeholder human rights impact assessment models that have been developed within this cross-community working party. We'll also be showcasing a new model for human rights impact assessments that has been under construction. And there are several of the people from this HRIA team that are on the call today. So hopefully we'll be able to share some insights into the challenges and lessons that we learned in the course of this work. We'll also be talking a little bit about a recent paper that was published by one of our members and about our session for the upcoming meeting at Kobe. I realized that I have actually neglected to introduce my co-chair, so I'll turn the mic over to her to introduce herself quickly before diving into the next slide. Akriti, is your audio working okay? No, we can't hear you. So maybe we can work on that. I'll go on to the next slide while we're working on that, and then just feel free to pipe up to test things out if you need to. So first, we're going to start with a bit of a retrospective, looking at the different human rights impact assessment models that have been put forth within the ICANN community until now. So some of you may recall that the first thing that was produced was an initial sketch. This was contributed by our CCWP member, Vidushi Marda, at the Abu Dhabi meeting in November 2017. I have just pasted a link to the document in the chat in case you wanted to have a look, but the main points were that it kind of mapped out the different criteria for carrying out an independent human rights impact assessment and then mapped these phases onto the steps of the generic name supporting organization policy development process. It was one of the key things that it brought to the table was charting objectives and responsibilities for each phase of the assessment. However, a lot of the community feedback we're having troubles. I'm going to carry on since this is more of a retrospective so that you guys can kind of work out your dial-ins by the time we get to the discussion. A lot of the feedback that we received at the end of November 2017 was that this work was premature, as Workstream 2 wasn't even close to being completed at that point. Other contributors also identified the additional burden on staff members who might not have the bandwidth or expertise to carry out an impact assessment, and there were concerns about that it was unclear how the community would be involved. So in response, the next iteration was the questionnaire model. And here I can also put a link in the chat. So the main development of this questionnaire model was that it was trying to be more inclusive in terms of participation so that more people could feed into this. very loud noise. And it wouldn't be completely dependent on ICANN's staff to carry it out. Oh my goodness, that was a loud noise. Sorry, got a little bit distracted. This was also building on previous work of the CCWP to identify the salient human rights that were impacted by ICANN's policies and operations. So, however, we received quite a bit of community feedback on this, saying that it was maybe not so clear how the different rights enumerated would relate to the work of the policy development process. So perhaps we could have added cues or links to help people make the connection. And people were unclear about who would carry this impact assessment out and when. I think that the key point here is that when we started trying to carry out the trial HRIA, we found that this form method was not very operational because the rights were too siloed and it was kind of hard just from a user experience perspective to scroll up and down and be able to fill in the information in the right place. So the next model that we developed was in the form of a spreadsheet. And here I can share the link to that. In the chat, you can just have a look at how the work was evolving. So this was, as we began getting involved in the PDP, in the subsequent procedure policy development process, we realized that a lot of the impacts were coming from proposed changes that had been recommended by the working group. So kind of looking at government or regulatory change models of impact assessments, we tried to base this on focusing on the status quo or changes. But this proved to also not be particularly operational, as not only was the link to human rights not very clear, but there was superfluous information that was added into the spreadsheet, and it was also difficult to process. And then a big concern was that this might have been what I've called a dead-end exercise, meaning that this wouldn't necessarily feed into the different work of the policy development process in a meaningful way. So this brings us to the current exercise. Before we get to here, I can just paste the current model. Here, I'll just skip around on these slides. So this brings us to the current model that we've been working with, which was developed earlier this year, just last month in January. And it similarly uses the collaborative spreadsheet format, but it's now geared towards recommendations. So now that you guys have this link in the chat so that you can have a look at the current model as we're talking about it, I want to back up and look at how this trial run on the subsequent applications proceed policy development process went and maybe get some feedback from some of the folks that contributed to the team who I can see are in on this meeting. So you will have seen that on the CCWP HR list, we jointly identified subsequent procedures as the most relevant policy development process for trial in November 2018. At that point, we assembled a small team of volunteers to help carry out the assessment, and they were mostly newbies, myself included. So our first step was gathering and reviewing resources on subsequent procedures to understand the state of play and the major actors and what was being decided. We formed a Slack channel to share resources and ideas on this. Over the course of the past couple months, people like, let's see, Austin, Yona, and Stefan and a couple others, and Akriti, of course, and I have all been contributing to meetings of the subsequent procedures, contributing, maybe observing is a better word, to try to see how this human rights impact assessment could be incorporated into this and other policy development processes. I think now I will open the floor to to the HRIA team members in particular, and see if anybody had any comments on challenges or lessons learned, or general experiences in contributing to subsequent procedures?
Hi everyone, Paula, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can, thanks.
Okay, so hi everyone, I meant to introduce myself. So I'm Ashwati Gopana. I work in Bangalore, India at the Center for Internet and Society. And so as of my engagement with ITAN, I was on the HRI team, and I think I don't know if this is a challenge that was unique to me, but I attended a couple of meetings, and I think the biggest thing, at least for me, was the fact that it was really dense. So even with subtools, I mean, I attended a couple of meetings, but all the materials that they were taught, I realized much later would involve preparation much before to sort of understand the meeting and what they were talking about, and all the documents that were put out were pretty long, it's pretty in-depth, and it's not as easy for somebody who's not been part of the process, and it's been going on for for years actually, so it's quite difficult to sort of suddenly pick up and sort of comment on the HRI, the impact, or what the sort of applications on the rights are. Everyone also seems so already like an expert, it's kind of hard to break into that that mold, so I think that was my only real sort of it was the biggest challenge to sort of understand what was happening and then kind of assess what the impact of it would be. So I think Colin was maybe better with that because I'm given experience with ICANN, and I'm hoping to get better at that in the couple of months that happen then follow.
Great, thanks for sharing that experience. Did any of our other trial HRIA team members have a similar experience or anything to add to that? Yes, David, I see you've got your hand raised. Please come in.
Hey, Colin, thank you very much. This is David McCauley speaking for the record. I wasn't part of that team, but I do have a question about it. And my question is, how does this fit in to the PDP process? I'm just not clear on that. In other words, you mentioned that you were observers. And so I'm wondering, is this just a test in the background, or does this have an impact in this particular PDP? Will it have an impact? Will these observations be made known to the group? Or is that reserved for, something that might be catastrophic? I don't even know if that's been identified. I tend to doubt it. But so I'm just trying to figure out, what does this mean to the PDP group itself? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. I was kind of flicking around in the slides because I thought that I had included something on there. This has been a big question. As Akriti mentioned, there were, and this was something that was echoed in our own channel quite often when we were discussing during subsequent procedures meetings, there were a lot of us who didn't necessarily see how this work that we were carrying out would be most effective within the subsequent procedures process as it stands, given that it is in the stage of the working group when over the past few months has been in reviewing the public comments received. So a lot of the things that we were logging and tracking were based on these public comments that have been received or based on the report that has already been written. In that way, our methodology has been largely retrospective rather than forward-looking. So I, as you can see in the spreadsheet, there was already quite a lot of work that was done to kind of begin teasing out these rights impacts and indeed making recommendations that would hopefully be able to be operationalized by the subsequent procedures group. However, one of the biggest questions about how human rights impact assessments will work in the ICANN policy development processes is when they should be carried out and how this work can kind of be folded back into the recommendations that are ultimately turned into policy within the process. So I'm not sure. I might defer to you, David, or to somebody else who has had a bit more experience in policy development processes or subsequent procedures. Where would you say that this work could come in? Would it be something that would be most effective in public comments, or is it something that could be posed to the working group chair and incorporated that way? I'd be happy to take note of any options that come up in today's meeting for further exploration.
Colin, hi, it's David McCauley speaking again. In reply to your question, I am not a member of Work Tracks 1 through 4 in this sub-pro PDP. I am taking part in Work Track 5, and so I really can't answer the question. I would suspect, but I don't know this, that public comments is a decent place, but there may be other opportunities as well. I really can't say because I'm not that familiar with the principal dynamics of this particular PDP. Maybe somebody else here is. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you for that contribution. This was something that we had considered as well as part of the team, which is one of the reasons why the most recent model that you see on your screen, which is actually called the REC model, is geared towards recommendations. One of the unexpected learnings that we got from participating in these subsequent procedure meetings in the current stage of the working group was that it became quite clear how to signpost and use really clear language in public comments in order for it to be more easily processed by the group in when they all come together, feed it into a spreadsheet, and go through all of the different recommendations made in public comments. So this is one of the reasons why we decided to try to almost reverse engineer this tool to be able to help interested community members make more informed and robust public comments that clearly link to the issues that are set forth from in either the report or whatever document or proposal is being commented on, teasing out the impact scenarios, human rights, vulnerable groups, and then making very clear recommendations based on these observations. The problem with this is that while a lot of, like as I mentioned, the HRIA methodology that we used was largely retrospective, so that means we were using a lot of desk research, looking at the wiki, reports, or mailing lists, and then relying very heavily on a review of public comments, which the comment from the Council of Europe and from the non-commercial stakeholder group and the at-large advisory committee were all really useful in that regard because they did a great job of identifying a lot of salient concerns related to human rights, and then also relying on guidance from staff. So in the future, one could imagine that when this is being carried out in an earlier phase of work of a policy development process, then this the recommendations of coming from the impact assessment could be creamed off and then fed into a public comment and worked into the PDP that way. But that being said, I don't have a great answer of how this work that we've already completed can be fed back into sub-pros. But I would say that a lot of these comments were already identified. A lot of these issues were already identified in public comments that were made on the issue report. So this is kind of more of an exercise in visualizing and creating a mechanism to be able to more faithfully engineer such comments moving forward. Does that make sense? Okay, great. So I've got a couple more things to cover before we move on to the next part of our agenda. So I wanted to really make this into a dialogue, if possible, and begin to ask the people on this call more of logistical questions about how this could be useful moving forward. So if the goal of this is to make more robust or informed public comments that can therefore feed into the process in that way, or and this is just an idea here, these are all drafts. It doesn't seem like the bylaw will be, as you saw in my mail, it doesn't seem like the bylaw is going to be coming into effect within the next 6 months. So we do have some time to test out models and try to really hone this and make it something useful for the community. But the first big question is, who should carry out these impact assessments? Does anybody have any thoughts or suggestions about who within the ICANN community or outside of it would be an appropriate person or people to do so? Okay, it seems like we've got a bit of a quiet call today, so we'll just skip to the next question of when this assessment should be carried out. Some of the ideas that were put forth were if it should be carried out as part of the initial issue report or even before when the PDP is being started, or if it should be something that is worked on continuously throughout the process and then only finished at the point of public comment. Does anybody have any input or feedback on timing?
So I would think that it would be useful to have it from the beginning, or just in terms of making it more consistent. So to identify issues that could come up in the beginning, and then if the issues are seen significant enough by the working group and whoever's working with them, then they could, you know, these are concerns that can then be addressed in the report to come, as opposed to just being identified and then sort of not incorporated within the working group.
That's a really good point. And that actually, I'm looking at the spreadsheet now, and maybe this column C isn't a great one, since you said that, because it seems like issue might not be a great word, because if we're talking about issues starting off, then it might be something, issue in the sense of a topic of conversation rather than issue in the way that it's used here, which is referring to something rather concrete that is related to a topic that was set forth in the report. So maybe this is, I'll mark this in yellow. Maybe we can think about terminology there. David, you've got a hand up. Please come in.
Thanks, Colin. David McCauley speaking again for the record. And just to answer the question of when, my suggestion would be that it would be sort of continuous through the work of the PDP from inception. I've taken part in a number of PDPs, and it seems to me that that way the person, if this is a standing committee, the CCWP is a standing committee, that, you know, maybe that could answer the question of who, people would from this committee join various PDPs as they're so inclined. But early participation would help them appreciate the PDP as it develops, and would also be fair to the PDP that issues in this respect would be raised early and probably better handled early than late. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And, yeah, that is a concern that has been raised in the past, that if people just kind of parachuted in and made comments from at a late stage or not, without having been involved previously, then it was unclear whether the recommendations would be given so much weight, or if they would be or if they would be accepted. So looking at the tools, since we've got, it's already been, right, it already seems to me that the word issues might be potentially problematic. Is there anything else that anybody has noticed in looking at the tool that is either missing, unnecessary, confusing? What do you think about the spreadsheet format? Is it something that works or doesn't? If this tool was put in front of you without any kind of explanation, would you be able to understand it? Yes, Akriti, please.
So there were two things that I thought that potentially could be added. One was whether there are any relevant international human rights legislations or instruments that talk about the rights that we're referring to. And maybe it doesn't have to be international in the terms of UN or anything, but sort of any, whether it's an EU directive or anything that sort of links back our human right to a more global framework. Does that make sense? I know it's difficult with an ICANN because ICANN is really specific in what it does. But I thought if you had that sort of aspect, then it would make our case stronger, so to speak. And the other thing I thought was if we should be, when we're doing assessment, and I know ICANN is doing their own internal HRIA, but if, when we're assessing risk to the state community in general, it would be useful to have a column where you're assessing risks to the organization. So then when you're looking at how much can be implemented or, you know, how much effort is going to take the organization to be implemented, there can be sort of a comparison like a vis-a-vis. And then when you're pitching it to, I mean, you know, whoever it comes up in the reports, we sort of already know or we can do a better job of sort of presenting to ICANN what needs to be done on their behalf. So sort of a risk assessment, even just on the implementation scale on behalf of the organization, you know. To with respect to that specific site or whatever comes up.
Awesome. Yeah, those are great suggestions. You'll see that I've added a new column H, which is applicable human rights law. That's a really good idea because of the wording of the bylaw, which is that ICANN will respect human rights as required by applicable law. So that's a really great addition. Does anybody else have any other comments on the spreadsheet, just the model itself? Okay, I think I might pick on someone, if I may. Joanna, I see that you have joined the call. Welcome. Thank you very much. I had noticed that you added a lot of language to the Eurolo hot topics about balancing rights, which was really interesting to me. Do you think that this tool, as it stands and the way that it's formatted, could be something useful in helping the at-large community perform identify these balancing acts? Okay, it seems that she is unavailable. Okay, well, we'll take these questions to the list. I don't really spend too much time on this because we've got other things on the agenda. So we'll take these questions to the list and keep on working on this methodology. Ah, she doesn't have a mic. That's okay. I just really liked what you were saying about the privacy and security and things like that. Great, we can take this to the list. All right, I'll move on to the next section and pass it over to my co-chair, Akriti. Oh, sorry, I had a hand. Bruna, would you like to say something before we move on?
Hi, Colin. Thanks for the floor and apologies for not typing it on the chat. But I was just wondering about the vulnerable groups tab, because I just don't know. I mean, please don't kill me for saying that. I do am aware about the need of highlighting, like, how it affects whether or not these programs or the decisions of the working group might affect vulnerable groups on this. But then I don't quite, I mean, unless we find that that the amount of times or how it affects vulnerable groups should be maybe a recommendation on how this program, like the music LDs program, should be maybe more concerned or more, I don't know, raising awareness to the effects of vulnerable groups, I would say that maybe we could transform this into one of the negative impacts or put it under the negative impact part, because it's just that, I mean, during the discussions I try to have on this in the past years, whenever I highlighted anything about vulnerable groups, I was told before that this was not the intent of the program. So I'm just thinking maybe fast-forwarding some criticism or maybe comments we might have to the chart. And that was it. Thanks, Colin.
Yeah, great. Thanks for that suggestion, Bruna. And that is definitely one of the goals. If this is a tool to be used, so we really want to be able to, while we want to keep it thorough and as comprehensive as possible, if people don't use it or if we have categories of information that are superfluous or unnecessary, then it might harm the longevity of these types of using these mechanisms to uphold the bylaw. So I think that's a great idea about including a mention of vulnerable groups in the negative impact scenarios. Yeah. I think that another potential modification that we could do to make things clearer is that we could add another tab within this spreadsheet that gives a bit of an explainer about what the different categories of information are. Perhaps even having some sort of drop-down menu for salient human rights, so people don't feel compelled to invent them on the fly. So yeah, those are great suggestions. Unless anybody has anything else to add about this tool, I will turn it over to Akriti.
So the paper that I'm going to summarize basically was written by Monica, but it's really early in the morning for her, so I'm going to present it instead. The paper largely deals with the need for ICANN in particular to have binding human rights obligations, and it essentially translates back to the framework of interpretation that was created during the working and accountability package. And that's something that I've written about also in November, the fact, sort of the lacunae with the FOI. So just to start off with the basic context in that, it was developed by WS2, and it was clarified that it was a core value and not a commitment. The former is an obligation, while the latter are not necessarily intended to apply consistently and comprehensively to ICANN's activities. To summarize the FOI, if the applicable law, that is the law practiced in the jurisdiction where ICANN is operating, does not mandate certain human rights, then they do not raise issues under the core value. So as such, there can be no enforcement of human rights obligations by ICANN or any other party against any other party. So since it's contingent on seat of operation, the law can vary through, by and large, ICANN, though by and large ICANN recognizes and can be guided by international human rights, but it basically boils down to the jurisdiction where they're operating. And it's important to remember that the international human rights instruments that are relevant are also those required by the applicable law. So apart, the FOI is worded negatively in that apart from its legal responsibility to uphold the human rights laws of an area, it states that ICANN should in general avoid violating human rights. So there's no positive sort of obligation to follow human rights, as in it's more of a, you know, falling short of not violating any. It's also said that they should take into account human rights when making policies, but they fall short from saying that these human rights considerations should be given prominent weightage. And additionally, I can have many core values, so at any point, one of the others can be used to sidestep human rights or for one to be given more importance. For example, there's another core value which says that ICANN should duly consider the public policy advice of governments and other authorities in arriving at a decision. So if, you know, there's a contradiction, if the government wants to promote a decision to further national interest at sort of expense of any human rights, then that would be very much possible within this framework of interpretation. So that is basically the context for what the paper was on, but the paper advocates for reframing of legal duties of informal actors like ICANN. And that was one of sort of the interesting points about the fact that whether we in general need legally binding human rights obligations or whether the status quo as it is sufficient. I'd love to hear from anyone if they have any particular thoughts about this. Okay, then.
Could you repeat the question, please?
Yeah, basically, I mean, the premise of her paper, and I thought it would be a good place to start, was whether we need ICANN to have legally binding international human rights obligations at all, or whether the status quo, or if people in the group, are, you know, the status quo is sufficient.
Yes, I see David has his hand up. Please come in.
Thank you. Thanks, both. This is David McCauley speaking for the record. And as somebody who was a participant in the CCWG and accountability and was actively involved in the discussion of the new bylaw on human rights, the one caution I would note is that in coming up with sort of blanket human rights obligations to fit onto ICANN, care needs to be taken to recall ICANN's limited role in Internet governance. And I'll use, Akriti, I'll use the second bullet on this on the screen here, this community discussion screen. The second bullet says appropriateness of the UN guiding principles. Excuse me. Using that as an example, I recall that the guiding principles were basically telling businesses, including ICANN, I suppose, if ICANN were to embrace the UN guiding principles, sort of carte blanche, but they tell them, if you have leverage among your business relationships, then use it to bring about a good human rights outcome. And ICANN, of course, has some leverage among registries and registrars. And registrars in particular can affect the operation of domain names. And so it could conceivably, at least, I think an argument could be made that it could drag ICANN into the content business where it has no business. And so that just sort of underscores the point I'm trying to make, that care needs to be exercised in embracing human rights to make sure that they fit, or ICANN has the flexibility to stay within its limited remit. So thanks very much for the question.
So if I may chime in here, I've been thinking about this. Actually, could I please ask people to mute their microphone if they're not speaking? We've got a little bit of an echo. Okay, cool. Even if we take into consideration the limited remit and all of the limitations that occur in the second half of the human rights bylaw after the bit that is easiest to remember, which is that ICANN should respect internationally recognized human rights as required by applicable law, I do see that sometimes we might have we might have an instance of the reliance on applicable human rights law and the deference to human rights policy, like corporate social responsibility, might not serve to reinforce each other, but rather to reduce the effectiveness of each other. And this is just a thought based on the difficulties that we've been having even in determining the applicability of laws like the GDPR, where does it apply, who does it apply to, how does it apply, and this didn't even become a question until we had the big fine that came into the picture. So when we're talking about ICANN respecting human rights as required by applicable law, I do think that it's while it's great to develop these types of mechanisms like we're doing, it's good to think critically about the ways that we could potentially incentivize this beyond what is required by applicable law through risk management or other mechanisms. Because I'm not sure if a legally binding international human rights treaty is necessarily on the cards. There's discussions of this in the United Nations, but and even if it became even if it happened, if and when, it's a question of if and when it would ever be applied to ICANN. So these are really great points that you are picking out, and that were, you know, that Monica teases out in her paper. So thanks for bringing them to the table.
There's basically also three reasons that you specifically mentioned why that these are important. And to quickly talk about them, the first reason she identifies is that currently, as the state is, there's an imbalance between hard legal commercial obligations and soft law. So whenever we see whether it's trade or investment or any sort of commercial international obligations, they're set in stone and they're hard and they're easier to enforce. But when we talk about human rights, it's always soft law. It's always a sort of weaker side of international law. The second reason is that when you have binding obligations for human rights, then it's easier for individuals whose rights have been violated to have an remedy, sort of a redressal mechanism. So those that are affected can access an effective remedy. And this doesn't currently exist under the ICANN bylaws precisely because of the sort of gray nature of ICANN's obligations to respect international human rights. And the last one suggests that private actors such as ICANN, and because of the work that they're engaging in, they themselves are in the act of balancing exercise around such rights. So if they don't have an explicit recognition of their human rights obligations, then how do you sort of go forward from here and develop access to justice, especially in the digital age? And this is why it comes down to sort of another motif in her paper, whether about enforcement is better done through domestic law or through international law instruments, whether they're, you know, instruments which have been suggested such as international trade agreements or foreign investment treaties. And, so I personally would think that international law instruments, if they can be as hard-earned as trade agreements and things like that, they sort of work better because domestic laws can vary so greatly across nations that they might not have the same uniform interpretation that an international law sort of convention can have, or at least some sort of international law guidance. Does anyone else have any differing opinions or any sort of opinion on this?
Well, it could be, to chime in, it could be interesting to consider how the European Union fits in here as kind of some sort of supranational law body, regional law, because recently at the high-level internet governance meetings they had in Brussels, they were talking about the theme of this year's IGF is going to be making a human rights-centered internet, which sounds very good, but as we've seen, can be very difficult to operationalize. So it could be that maybe trying to apply a group or regional legislation or something that's not necessary. Well, I guess European law could be a good case study to start with, which is another reason why I'm super glad to see that Joanna is here from Euralo. because this is quite in line with a lot of the charter for the European Charter on fundamental freedoms and things like that. Whereas the United States, for example, where it might be a good fit to leverage legislation on ICANN, they don't have very robust human rights protections codified into law as such.
One of the other issues that she sort of points out is that ICANN insists that human rights issues are not relevant to its narrow sort of technical mission, but a lot of its policies entail direct human rights implications. A lot of their policies have attached criticism. We've seen civil society campaigns for policy ranging from privacy concerns with the Who Is policy, due process concerns with protecting trademarks under the Uniform Dispute Resolution Policy, to excessive personal data retention requirements in the IR agreements. There's also the parallel thing, again, with something I find problematic as well, is with ICANN's contractual agreements, which lack choice of law clauses. And so the jurisdiction issue that is an amalgamation of many little issues within it was never particularly resolved within the WS, one or two sort of recommendations as well. And flowing from that, I mean, the question would really come down to what principles in international law currently are relevant to ICANN, and it would seem that there are no really principles that are directly relevant for private informal actors like ICANN, because they're usually created for nation states. They're applicable only to, signatories that ratify these agreements and are generally legally binding only to states. And even when it comes down to what international conventions might be applicable under jurisdictional law, since jurisdictions remain uncertain, and because of ICANN's status as a private organization, it's very difficult to ascertain which country has ratified a human rights convention, which domestic human rights legislation applies to ICANN, whether it's only vertically these legislations apply, that is to public bodies, or whether it applies to private actors. There's some sort of laws which are universally applicable, so like anti-discrimination laws, maybe personal data protection, labor standards, etc. But by and large, it would appear that ICANN is not generally required to respect internationally recognized human rights by applicable law. Another thing is that the enforcement mechanisms for these self-imposed commitments are not very strong. So one of the mechanisms that ICANN had envisioned was the independent review mechanism, but she talks about how that's only been used once since it came up, and quite less for the number of conflicts that ICANN policies have had and could have potentially had with human rights obligations. And because of ICANN's non-profit character, some of the soft comments that they hold up because of CSR or what we would think that companies usually have to sort of uphold, because they don't have any direct consumers, they don't have the sort of pressure that general corporations have to uphold any of the human rights obligations that can potentially come up. But that's pretty much what her paper talks about. It's a really good paper. Everybody should read it out, and I will post a link here for anybody. And if anyone else wants to talk about it, then Colin and I are here to talk more about it. But otherwise, is there any other questions? Yeah, and Monica. Sorry, yeah. And if there's no one else who has any questions, then we could move on to ICANN's Successful Agenda. So what we've envisioned for the meeting, and if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm mistaken, I think it's on a Wednesday, Colin?
I will look that up right now.
So as far as I know, it's on a Wednesday, and what we're looking at discussing is firstly updates on the CCWG accountability workstream to implementation. We had one at ICANN 63, and since we've not heard much more from them, so we're planning to have someone talk about that. There might be new members, or even for old members, to have like a refresher on the human rights bylaw and the framework of interpretation, the extent of it, the scope of it, what exactly it entails or binds, if anything it does, what it binds the organization to. the results of our human rights impact assessment. So we'll go through the methodology, the results, what recommendations we've come up with, and how further to sort of go from that. And lastly, we're looking at having an open community discussion about whether these impact assessments are a tool for constructive engagement across stakeholder groups at all, or, you know, and to better have this conversation, who should we invite in the room, who else should we reach out to, how to have sort of the best, most open-minded but less inclusive conversation about these. So if any of you have any suggestions about it, please let us know. Or if there's anything else that someone would like to sort of talk about or address. But otherwise, yeah, this is what the agenda looks like.
Great, yeah, and I just wanted to hammer home any recommendations on who we could get in the room. I actually ran into someone from the NTIA the other day by chance, and we found it quite interesting how much we agreed on at the end of the day about, you know, having more robust discussions and having kind of less, more interactions between stakeholder groups. So this could be a really great opportunity to see what the utility of these different mechanisms could be for people from across the community, even if they want to come and tell us that it's horrible and shouldn't be implemented. So would anybody have any suggestions? Some things that have come up previously would be members of the GAC, International Human Rights Working Group, or even the Public Safety Working Group. But is there anybody else that, or constituencies or even individuals who might be interested in talking about trade-offs between privacy, security, freedom of expression, and other rights? All right, noted. We'll pose that question to the list as well. We can give people time to think and reflect, and then maybe we can do a bit of outreach and see if we can get a bunch of different kinds of people in the room so that we can have a more robust discussion and make maximum use of our face-to-face time. All right, with that, I think that we can just move to the very last bit of our agenda, which is any other business. Is there anything that anybody wanted to raise, flag, or otherwise talk about before we leave the call? Okay, perfect. It seems like there is none. So I'll go ahead and say that we can stop the recording and wrap the meeting up here. Thanks for everyone who came, and we are looking forward to seeing you in person in Kobe.
Thank you very much, Colin. Thank you, everyone, for attending the call. Goodbye.
See you on the list.